You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Joining us today on the show is Dr. Candy Leonard. Dr. Leonard is a sociologist. She is also the author of the book Beatleness, How the Beatles and Their Fans Remade the World. Candy, thank you very much for taking the time to join us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, just a few things about this book, because this is a different book. There have been a lot of books written about the Beatles, especially last year during the 50th anniversary of Beatlemania. Everybody was trying to make a buck, I guess, but then everybody was also trying to reminisce and bring back the Beatles. But it seems like the Beatles have never been forgotten. I think you said at one point, as long as people listen to music, there will always be Beatles.
Yeah, I think that that's certainly true, yeah.
I like the Beatleness. I like the way you describe it and you define it. If you wouldn't mind sharing that with us, you say it's a noun.
Yeah, there are sort of three definitions of Beatleness. One is the feelings that they evoke. You know, one of the words that fans use over and over again is joy, that the Beatles brought them joy. But it's a particular kind of joy. It's a feeling that they evoke, that their music evokes. That's Beatleness. That's the feeling. The other meaning of Beatleness is the qualities or characteristics of them, their talent, their creativity, their attitude, their style, their wit, everything that, you know, the whole package, you know, the essence of them, if you will, that's Beatleness. And the third definition is, you know, we all, those of us who are Beatles fans, notice references to them everywhere, whether it's in headlines in newspapers or advertising or parodies of record covers. They're just references to them everywhere. So that's the third definition. In other words, these things that we see out in the world that are like, oh, that's a reference to the Beatles, and they're very commonplace. And I think that they'll continue to be because they have become so much a part of the culture. But I have to make up a word because there was really no word to describe this thing, this whole phenomenon, the feeling, the pervasiveness of them for 50 years.
I like the word. Do you think Wikipedia or one of the other dictionaries are going to pick it up? I mean, Google became a verb.
That's right. People are using it. I know that a lot of people who've read the book are finding the word very useful and are kind of dropping it into the vocabulary. And I've seen it on Facebook posts and a couple of reviews and things. So we'll see if it catches on. You know, it's funny. For the longest time, people weren't even asking me what it meant. It was just this, you know, you sort of got it immediately. Oh, yeah, Beatlemas, you know, it's them. It's, you know, the multifaceted experience of them. But, yeah, I'd love to see the word catch on. Absolutely.
I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, Candy, that there have been a lot of books written about the Beatles, especially during the 50th anniversary. But you state in your book that you wanted to write this book because you wanted to fill several gaps, three actually, in the vast Beatle literature. And the fact that the other books have not touched on these three gaps. You want to fill us in on that?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I noticed over the years was that there were no books from the fan perspective, which struck me as kind of interesting when you consider that the fan aspect of the phenomenon was huge. You know, we had never seen anything like that. So the fan perspective on what it was like to experience the Beatles was missing. Also, most Beatle books, you know, book-length discussions of the Beatles are written by men, probably 99.9%, which, again, is kind of ironic when you consider that the female, you know, so not only are fans missing from this vast body of Beatle literature that's out there, but the female voice is missing as well. And which, again, so much about them was about female fans. So here we are so many years later, no one's looking at it from those perspectives. And the third gap was that, you know, people always say the Beatles changed everything, the Beatles changed everything. So I wanted to kind of look at that and see what did they change, what does that mean, and how did they do it? And so by talking to fans and getting their first-person narratives and their stories and their experiences at that very personal level, then you put those narratives together collectively, and that's where the kind of the sociology of it comes in, because I spoke to all these fans of different ages, you know, male and female, and putting their stories together collectively, you can see how, in fact, they changed everything one fan at a time, and then collectively, as a generation, how they inspired baby boomers to think differently and question things and, you know, not take things for granted anymore.
It's interesting that you mentioned about the sociology and the male and female, and I want to touch on this in just a minute. But you make reference in your book also to Dr. Joyce Brothers and her book on how she tried to explain Beatlemania. I am not familiar with that book. You want to kind of fill us in on that?
Well, she didn't write a book, but when Beatlemania hit in February of 64, people were, newspapers were covering it. It was a huge deal. I mean, they became a cultural frame of reference. Everybody was talking about them, and not only the kids who loved them, and kids as young as you and I were, we were seven, but teenagers, everybody was talking about them. Johnny Carson, Walter Cronkite, and it was just a huge deal. And one of the things that was puzzling to observers was the screaming. Why are they screaming? Why is all this kind of frenzy behavior? So Joyce Brothers, who many young people may not know who she is, but she was sort of the first sort of famous shrink. She was sort of like the godmother to Dr. Phil and Drew Pinsky, if you will. She was the go-to popular shrink. And so they asked her, what is all this about the screening and all this? And that was the thing that baffled people the most. And you have to remember, too, this was in 1954. The world was a very different place. And so to have young women just misbehaving like this in public and losing control and being in this ecstatic state was kind of threatening to the social order, really, of the very conservative, conformist 60s. Of course, that was all about to explode big time. And Beatlemania was really the start of that.
And it's interesting because a lot of people talk about the 60s as the age of innocence. And as you were mentioning, it was not kosher, if you want to use that word, to say you can't act that way in a concert.
Right. Well, rock and roll was always considered a little bit dangerous. And some of it was actually coming from a sort of a racist position, if you will, that it was called jungle music. I mean, if you think back to the early innovators like Chuck Berry and Little Richard, there was a concern that it was the reaction to some of these early rock and rollers that resulted in this period in the early 60s where there were these single male crooners who were all kind of carbon copies of the other Bobby Lee, Bobby Vinton, Troy Chandel, Paul Anka, Fabian, Ricky Nelson. They're not all comparable. Some had certainly more talent than others. But there was this whole slew of sort of what were perceived as safer rock and roll singers. Pat Boone was in that category. Rock and roll was seen as very threatening, and even, when Rock Around the Clock came out, it's used as the famous song Committee Blackboard Jungle, which there were apparently riots when that movie first was released because of this, it was a period where teenagers and young people were beginning to question things, what was their role, but nothing like it happened later in the 60s. History is a continuous line, so it really is a question of like where do you punctuate it and where do you look for the change that you're interested in. But so there was really a continuum of change. But when the Beatles came, it was a whole new quantum leap.
We're visiting with Dr. Candy Leonard. Dr. Leonard is a sociologist. He is also the author of the recent book Beatleness: How the Beatles and Their Fans Remade the World. Candy, speaking of fans, you center your book on fans born between 1945 and 61. Why did you pick that time?
I wanted to capture the experience of first-generation fans. And the people who were born in 45, they were 19 when the Beatles came. That was sort of the older end. And, from what I'd read and learned and spoke to people over the years before actually starting the book, that once you got over 20 years old, they were less oriented towards the Beatles. I mean, they liked them and were interested in them, but it was really like through high school, early college maybe, was really where, at the older end. And then at the younger end, it's actually a little more tricky because I wanted to talk to people who remembered the before and after or who remembered their earliest memories were infused with Beatles. So while the technical definition of a baby boomer is 1940 to 1964. Obviously, people born in 1964 would have no memory of this. So I was trying to talk to fans who, you know, at the full end, the full spectrum of age of young people who would have been tuned in and really paying attention. So even, you know, the youngest fan I interviewed, I think there was one or two that were born in 61, so they were between 3 and 4 when the Beatles entered their lives. And these people now in their 50s, you know, claim to remember these very early songs, hearing the songs on the radio, and also remembering their older siblings getting very involved and caught up in it. And so that was a big part of it, too. If you had an older sibling, you got brought into it a little bit earlier. But what's interesting about that age range, it's a very wide age range, but yet the Beatles were the unifying focal point for baby boomers across that wide age range.
You mentioned, well, actually, at the beginning of the interview, you and I talked about the fact that we're both the same age. And I was baffled, I guess, your teacher, when she returned your paper and saying the Beatles were not newsworthy.
Well, of course, I mean, I'm thinking, what is she talking about? They're on every newspaper, they're on every magazine, everybody's talking about them on TV, et cetera. And I'm thinking, like, this woman, like, it was really a first instance of me as a young person feeling like an adult is telling me something that's not true or that's trying to sort of necessarily keep me in line. But in other words, like, well, do I trust my eyes or do I listen to what this woman said, that the Beatles are not newsworthy? I think at the time it was considered frivolous and, you know, obviously she wanted me to bring in articles, you know, something that was more conventionally newsworthy, you know. But why that stuck with me all these years is that I knew then that they, not only were they newsworthy as we all saw them, you know, emblazoned on every magazine and newspaper that was around, but there was another level that I think even at that young age, I got the sense that this was a big thing that I was witnessing, that this was a, and I didn't know the word phenomenon, obviously, but there was a level of excitement and depth to it and breadth to it also. It's not only going on here, this is going on all over the world. And I felt that I was witnessing something extraordinary.
Candy, you were one of the fortunate ones who got to go to Liverpool, a whirlwind trip of Liverpool, and you got to see the statue that says Four Lads Who Shook the World. And I want to tie that into your dream, your Paul dream.
You want me to tell the whole story about the dream?
Sure.
Okay, well, there is a statue in Liverpool. It says Four Lads Who Shook the World. And I have a very, very vivid memory of seeing an article, a picture and a caption. It was probably in the Long Island Press or New York Times. I grew up in New York. Those were the papers that were in the house. Of this statue being installed and it said Four Lads Who Shook the World. And again, so by that time, maybe I was 8 or 8 and a half. And it was consistent with my sense that, yeah, like, this is something big here. This is, like, shaking things up. Okay, so fast forward. So this is, you know, I have this dream where I see Paul McCartney on a bus, and we get into this conversation about the Beatles and their influence on culture, and particularly in the 60s. And I said to him in the dream, you know, basically presented the case that they were really huge agents of change. And I said, just like that statue says, Four Lads Who Shook the World. And he said, shook your world, maybe. And I'm thinking, well, so, and that was kind of the end of the dream. And it left me with this thought that if they shook my world and my brother's world and my friend's world and all the kids in my class at school and all the kids in the neighborhood who were so shook by this, that's the collective influence right there. In other words, it that was the sociology of it to me, you know, looking at sort of how the experience of the individual at the micro level, the personal level, relates to the, you know, what we refer to as the macro level, the societal change, the social structural change. So if all of these young people were similarly affected, that's how they changed the world. You know, that's how they did it. So, and then, of course, as you asked earlier, what does that mean to change? And so in the book, when you narratives of fans describing how some encounter with some Beatle lyric or performance or film or discussion with friends, which was a constant thing we talked about and constantly still do, a lot of fans, that you were transformed by this, that you started to see things differently, and you were caught up in this thing. And over the course of the 60s, as things, as not only the Beatles changed, but as the generation gap emerged, the Vietnam War escalated, the civil rights movement, all these things that were going on became part of this huge change that we were witnessing and also abetting in our own way. Now, maybe you and I at 7 or 8 were not, but, you know, the young people, and I talked about this in the book, that even, take for example, Woodstock, which was, you know, late, that's already August of 69, there were fans that I interviewed who were, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13, and of course, oh, I was too young to go to Woodstock, they would say, but yet they still tuned in. They knew about it, they knew which bands were playing, and they felt that's where they belonged, that was, even though they were too young to be there. And so we forget that a lot of these first-generation fans were young like you and I. I mean, we were really kids. In fact, if you look at a bar graph of the baby boom, the 1957 was the peak year. So, you know, it's sort of, if you kind of follow that logic, you know, the first generation Beatles fans were kids. You know, the bulk of these boomers who were tuned in were really quite young.
When you talked about the female fans earlier, and yes, when we see cutaway shots of the Ed Sullivan Show, you see the screaming girls, you see some of them who look like they're in shock, and a lot of the males are just sitting there dressed up in their best suits, almost like their mom made them go with their sister or their girlfriend. But You write in your book that the ladies, the young girls, teenagers, had a crush on these four lads from Liverpool, but they felt like it was a safe crush because, after all they wanted to do was, I want to hold your hand, is what you say in your book.
Yeah, they were very, very appealing, but they weren't threatening. You know, and part of why they weren't threatening is that they presented a different kind of male persona, a different kind of masculinity that women, young girls, teenage girls, sound very appealing. In fact, if you read the in the book, the narrative, you know, say they were not macho. You know, they weren't like the football players. You know, that, and there was one thing about them. I mean, this softer masculinity added to the appeal. And what became obvious over the course of the decade, in fact, really very early on after they arrived, was that girls liked that. You know, women liked that. Women liked long hair. Women liked men who seemed a little bit more emotionally vulnerable, more expressive, and, you know, dressing in a softer sort of way. And, you know, this continued over the course of the decade. So that it was really not only about the fashion, but that there was this sense of, you know, again, this softer masculinity. Now, that said, the Beatles in their personal lives were not necessarily paragons of liberated men. But in the music, there was definitely if you compare their lyrics to the other pop songs at the time, I mean, they're more sophisticated and different in a number of ways, but one of the ways they're different is that the relationships presented, the power relationships between men and women, are much more egalitarian in Lennon McCartney lyrics than a lot of what we were listening to at the time. Now, of course, there's the egregious exception of Run For Your Life, but, you know, it was very common, though, in Beatles songs, they refer to women as friends. There's this notion of reciprocity and communication, and women like that. You know, it was very, very appealing, particularly this started with Rubber Soul, where the complexities of, you know, love relationships starts to be explored. And fans, women, girl fans always listen to the lyrics more. And that became especially true after Rubber Soul.
Now, they were very neatly packaged and presented by Brian Epstein. And as you mentioned, the suits, before you didn't see rock and roll groups in suits. You saw them in regular shirts or T-shirts. And they started Beatlemania. They started the British invasion in 1964. And ironically, in 1974, it ended with Paul McCartney and Wings coming back to the U.S. this is what I heard in a documentary once, that Walter Cronkite was interested in all this hoopla that's happening with his Beatles. So he had a story that was going to air November 22nd. Of course, we all know what happened that day. And that story was shelved, and then it was brought back later because they thought, well, you know, maybe this will help the country get over all this grief.
Well, I don't know that, I mean, if Cronkite said that after the fact, I mean, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the historical accident, really, of the Beatles arriving 79 days after the Kennedy assassination. I mean, it was incredibly quick. You know, we forget, it was less than 3 months. And there was definitely this sense of that they changed the mood of the country. I mean, journalists loved writing about them. They were fun. They were clever. And I mean, that first press conference where they just wowed the New York press corps that had assembled at Kennedy Airport. You know, they went in with kind of, okay, what's all this fuss about? And they were just blown away by the Beatles' charisma and, you know, their cleverness, their ability to banter with them. And if you think about back to Kennedy, his early, you know, his press conferences too, it was the same kind of thing. In other words, the Beatles, not only were they uplifting and fun to write about and sort of a distraction, but they seem to represent to young people something similar to Kennedy in that they were, first of all about youth, all about youth, youth ascendancy, the power of young people, and possibility, the optimism, that there was something new in the air. It's almost like they brought a new frontier. You know, Kennedy talked about the new frontier. They brought this kind of feeling of possibility that things, something was different in the world after they came.
When you talked earlier about that most of the scholastic and academic research has been done by males, when you talked earlier about press conferences, did you find it kind of ironic that most of the reporters were male, but they were also older men?
Yeah, well, I mean, in a sense, it's not surprising. I mean, how many women journalists were there in 1964? You know, I mean, there's that. But also, I think that a lot of the, when we look at that old footage, a lot of those news people, they may actually have been younger than they looked, because to our eyes today, because of the way that people were dressed and stuff,
yes,
they seem to look older. But certainly they were not in the fan base. In other words, they might have been in their 20s or 30s, you know, some of the reporters. But everybody was kind of curious about them. What was it all about? But the fact that there were no women reporters is really not at all surprising, all things considered. I mean, there were how many? I mean, even now, if, I mean, you know, a presidential press conference, there are relatively few women. So certainly 1964... that absolutely would have been great.
As you carry on through your book, the chapters are devoted to various albums and various eras. And one of the quotes I read by one of the fans of the Beatles, they said when Revolver was released, this young lady said, "We tried to find a song on Revolver that we liked, and we didn't. It was very hard for them to accept that change."
Yeah, Revolver was the beginning of the psychedelic period. And a lot of fans, particularly younger ones, but not only younger ones, started to find the Beatles a little bit too challenging. I mean, the challenge was part of the appeal, but Revolver, particularly some of the cuts on it, were becoming a little bit too challenging, too weird. It didn't sound like, it wasn't pleasing to their ear, as one fan said. So, but this is when the Monkees enter the scene, because Revolver comes out in August of 66. And then for some of these young fans, like, I don't know, you know, Smart Never Knows, Love You Too, even Tax Man, it's like too much. So the Monkees TV show debuts September 1966, and a lot of these younger fans, it's not that they stopped liking the Beatles, but they took a little break, what I call the Beatle break, and the Monkees then came on, were on the front burner. The Beatles moved a little bit to the back burner. But what's interesting about this from the with the whole social change and, you know, what happened in the 60s aspect of this, is that the Monkees communicated that same countercultural ethos that the Beatles were putting forth at that point, only the Monkees were, you know, they were packed, you know, they looked more like the early innocent Beatles. You know, they didn't have, you know, the facial hair. They were sort of more like they were younger, you know, they seemed younger. So they were, the Monkees kind of were a placeholder, but they, kids who were following the Monkees still got the same countercultural message. And if you fast forward to the summer of 67, the summer of love, as it's called, the high points of the hippie movement. When Sgt. Pepper came out in June of 67, the Monkees album Head was already on the charts. It was number one. Sgt. Pepper displaced it at number one. But those two records throughout the summer of 67 were number one and number two. So if you, depending on what form of, in other words, people were listening to both. Young people were listening to both. But some of the younger kids who were just listening to the Monkees were getting messages about peace, love, question the grown-ups, the angst, all the stuff that was going on then. Head, by that point, the Monkees were playing their own instruments and writing their own songs. They had really become a real group, which they, of course, did not when they were put together for the TV show. But if you listen to that Monkees album, Head, it's really fascinating in its, it's like a hippie record.
It's very different from other Monkee records. Now,
well, it was more sophisticated.
Yes,
in its own way,
yes.
Yeah.
Oh, do you remember that in the audience that first night when the Beatles appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show, Davy Jones was there performing a Broadway play, and he
yes.
said, "I want to be that. I want to be like that."
Right. Yeah. It's another one of the sort of historical accidents that Davy Jones was in the cast of Oliver.
Yeah.
And happened to be on the Ed Sullivan Show that night singing, yeah.
The first political song, I think, and I agree with you, you mentioned, is Nowhere Man that the Beatles came out with.
I think so. I consider that their first political song because, based on what the fans told me, that the takeaway was, and I mean, listen to the, I mean, it's so familiar, it's hard to kind of reframe our listening and put on our virgin ears again. But back in 66, the takeaway for fans was pay attention, ask questions, have opinions, be engaged in the world. It was almost like a call to action, if you will, for the, what we thought over the next few years. And we know that Lennon was very against the war in Vietnam and was by 66, already talking about it here and there. And so Nowhere Man comes out in early 66, and it was really a completely different kind of 45. I mean, it was not a Boy Meets Girl. It was not a love song. It was what was it even about? It was hard to even figure out. But the takeaway for fans, as I said, was pay attention, be engaged, ask questions, have opinions.
We want to thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. We've been visiting with Dr. Candy Leonard. The name of the book is Beatleness, How the Beatles and Their Fans Remade the World. And, of course, you can find it online, any of your favorite bookstores. And it's a great book, very interesting. And she talks about the years 1945 to 64. The Beatles started out with I Want to Hold Your Hand. And in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make. Candy, thank you very much for being with us here.
Thank you.
And in the end, take is equal to the love you make.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Norma Martinez. We had help from Belinda Fernandez and DJ Orozco. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Luis Sainz.